Thank you for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Christina, how goes it?
Pretty fabulous. How are you?
Not bad. How's your weather on the other side of the state? Always got to talk about
Milwaukee,
weather.
Milwaukee didn't get nearly anything. Yeah, we've had some flurries. We've even had some rain. So
wow.
You guys have gotten all the fun snow.
Yeah. So now they can tell when we recorded because we just got hit with that snowstorm, that one day 10 incher. So, yeah. Anyways, so should we continue our conversation on dietary guidelines?
Yeah. Tell me about Brazil.
Yeah. So I think we mentioned last time, right? I think I set the plate a little bit about like the new guidelines that we have in the United States, which, you know, on some level I'm happy with, right? Did you see that commercial during the Super Bowl?
No.
The Super Bowl. The Super Bowl. What's that?
Yeah.
I must have been the government that sponsored it. I don't know. I didn't even look into it. I think it was Mike Tyson, and he was eating an apple. It was like done in black and white, and he talked about his parents, and I think he talked about family history of diabetes or obesity, something like that. I don't quite remember. And then it was just ended with eat real food.
Wow.
It really was
great.
A good commercial. Yeah. If you haven't seen that, you know, I think it's worth looking up and seeing that, right? And I'm like, did the government pay for that? I wonder. Like, I didn't do my due diligence, but you know, that kind of makes me happy, right? You see real food. Let's eat real food. The question, of course, is how far we're going to go with that, right? Because eat real food, you don't have to legislate that. Like, how do we define real food?
Right.
That's kind of tough, right? I mean, is butter real food? Butter's still a processed food. But it's, you know, processed so that it's got some preservative value and, you know, for other reasons, right? How do we turn milk into something that we can use and keep for a period of time? But that's processing, right? And that's what we do in our kitchen. We process foods. We make them more edible so that we can extract calories from them. Mm-hmm. Or so they taste better too, right? Of course, that's part of it. But if you think about that, if you're like making, I don't have an example, like, you know, in developing countries where somebody is cooking for hours to be able to cook something so that they're able to actually cook it down because you're cooking a whole grain so that you can actually make it digestible and get some calories from it. Anyways,
okay,
moot point, right? But so this is the idea that, you know, eating real food. Now, so will we go as far as Brazil does? Right, so Brazil's got completely different guidelines than the United States does. And they really, you know, they're more focused on sort of the food system. Or I shouldn't say that. They're focused on, you know, like food culture. Like food culture is a super important thing. And, you know, and they deliberately will say, don't eat processed foods. Like, or ultra-processed foods, right? We make that distinction between ultra-processed and processed. And I think I talked about that last month, and maybe we can come back to that, but there's a NOVA classification. So NOVA is actually, it's a Brazilian that came up with it, right? And I don't know if he works for the ministry, or he must be a researcher. But so they basically use that, and that's a classification for foods. So there's NOVA group 1, group 2, group 3, group 4, right? And it's
According to how much it's processed?
Yes, correct. So I'll just review that. I know, so there's nothing wrong with repeating myself, I hope, right? But so group 1 is unprocessed or minimally processed, right? So that's now making food edible, safe, or storable. So that's like washing, cutting, freezing, drying, pasteurizing, right? We talked about this last time, pasteurizing. But that's, you know, minimally processed, let's say. Group 2 is processed culinary ingredients, right? That's where butter comes in. That's sugar. That's salt, right? So there you somehow mill it. Maybe you refine it. You press it. You do something, right? And refining, we say, oh, that's processed. Well, but anyways, that's group 2. Group 3 is now processed foods. That's now canning, fermenting, baking, curing. That's cheese, canned beans, canned fish. Right, but still, you know, I think we can tell it's derived from a whole food. And then it's group 4 that's the biggest problem, right? That's the ultra processed foods. So now we're talking about shelf stability. We're talking about hyperpalatability, convenience, right? That's what's behind these. And they're also highly profitable, right? So keep that in mind. Yeah. I mean, the food industry, I mean, the thing in the grocery store is, you know, what goes bad and where do they make all their money? And if they've got a food product that lasts for 10 years, that's really good, right? Because then you can eat it for 10 years. Right, that's why, I mean, in my book, sardines are like Armageddon food. If things went down, I would like go to the grocery store and I would buy steel or you know, whatever, every can of sardines I could get. Mm-hmm. That would be it. Like if I could go. I mean, I've never really camped where I've put everything on my back and gone. But if I did that, I'd be like, I'd just bring sardines with. Though I got to get rid of the can. Maybe that would be a problem. I have to carry the can out. But sardines, like, perfect. It's got protein. I mean, you put them in olive oil. It's got fat with it as well. And there's some fat in the sardines as well. And as long as you've got, you know, if it's not deboned, you actually get calcium and minerals from that too because you're eating the spine.
Oh, yeah, the bones, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's like Armageddon food for sure. Anyways, ultra-processed food. Here's the words, right? Fractionization, recombination, additives, texture, mouthfeel. It's modified starches, protein isolates, emulsifiers, flavor enhancers, right? All those things. Bad, right? I mean, we can pretty much across the board say this is a problem. But now we get into, you know, protein powders. Are protein powders a good thing or are they a bad thing? Oh, I need a protein powder because I'm working out. So you're doing protein, you're doing your protein shake in the morning, or you're taking your, you know, scoop of fruits and vegetables that has 15 servings of scoop, you know, servings of fruits and vegetables in one scoop. You're like, I don't need to eat. I've got a manufactured food. It's my mom drinking her protein drink every morning. Yeah. When I see her,
yeah,
she's like, I
yeah,
drink
that's
my protein
very
drink.
Popular.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
right.
Right. She's yeah. got the, which one does she get? She gets it from Sam, no, from Costco. Which one is
sure.
it? Premier? No, it's not Ensure. I think it's Premier Protein. She drinks that. She's like, oh, I get my protein, right? Because that's what I always harp on her. I'm like, Mom, could you eat an egg? How about eating some chicken? And my sister actually makes her egg bites, and she likes them. And I'm like, that's really good. She, you know, my sister puts them together, and she can, you know, heat up an egg bite that's like basically kind of a scrambled egg kind of thing with a little bit of sausage in it. You know, that makes me happy. That's, you know, that's now you're eating real food instead of eating drinking your protein shake. But if your goal is to get protein, what difference does it make? But that's America, right? This is what we do in America. We're looking to streamline. We're looking for convenience. We're looking for taste. You know, we're looking for all those things. And if we work out, oh my gosh, I got to get more protein. And you know, high protein diet's pretty popular right now. Right? They're kind of pushing keto out. It's like high protein, high protein, high protein. And how do you get high protein? It's really difficult if you just eat a standard diet to get, you know, your protein level like even above, I'd say even 20%. Standard American diet is about 15 to 16% protein percentage. And it's pretty consistent. Like if you're trying to go high protein, you deliberately have to eat things that are lower, you know, low fat protein. You need to eat lean protein.
In order to up your protein in the day?
Yeah, because when you eat, you know, if you eat, you know, ground beef, for example, you get a lot of fat with that. And fat carries a lot of calories with it. I'm talking percentage calories here. So, a gram of fat has 9 calories. A gram of protein has about 4. So in other words, you know, the nutrient density or the caloric density of that is much different. So you eat lean beef. Lean beef still has a fair amount of fat in it. You're still getting a lot of calories from fat. So in other words, if you're really pushing protein, and I mean, I've seen this with, you know, bodybuilder friends that I know, right? They, you know, their watch goes off and they go to the kitchen and they eat their chicken breast, right? I mean, they're, you know, it's like chicken breast, like nothing on it, just plain chicken breast. So they're getting, you know, relatively high protein, you know, they're getting high protein and lower fat, right? Because protein, you know, chicken breast is lower fat, still has some fat in it. But that, and you know, that then leads to the penultimate weight loss diet, which is the protein sparing modified fast. Which is basically you're just eating lean protein. So it's low fat, low carb. So you're keto, but you're really not keto. You're low-fat keto. Low-fat keto is not really keto, but, well, I guess it's keto. You're in ketosis, but it's a low-fat, low-carb. You take both those out. So you're just basically eating protein. And people lose weight, and they feel good, and, you know, it's like kind of magic for a weight loss. But it's hard to maintain, right? And super boring.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing, basically. I feel like you just described
what I'm doing.
I'm listening very carefully to all the details, and I'm like, check, check. I just eat steak and a smoothie every day. And it is. It's very boring.
Yeah, but you're getting some fat and some carbohydrates in there, yes? What's in that
sometimes,
smoothie?
Sometimes, yeah. So when I crave it, basically, But otherwise, I mean, there are days when I only eat steak and the smoothie that I had, you know, in the morning. So
but for deliberately for weight loss, right? So that's where you're, you know, only eating chicken breast, only eating white fish, only eating turkey breast.
Yeah, no, I'm not doing it for weight loss, although that is an ancillary consequence of what I'm doing. I have lost my perimenopausal weight as a result of just eating steak.
So,
I'm doing it because I'm working a lot and it's manual labor and I don't have a lot of time. Also, Invisalign. Invisalign is a great weight loss program. I'm going to suggest it to anybody who wants to lose weight because it's such a pain to take the retainers out and then brush your teeth and brush the retainer. So I'm eating like twice a day because I just don't want to deal with it.
Wow, that's an ancillary side effect, adverse effect of Invisalign, right? So you know,
I wouldn't call it adverse, to be
honest.
Well,
no, yeah, not adverse. You're right, right. Maybe you do it for that effect. I mean, it's almost like you go on a keto diet. What's the effect of the keto diet? You're just like, I don't want to eat anymore. I'm totally full. I don't want to even eat any bacon. Like, I'm just stuffed or I'm not hungry. And so you eat less.
So true.
Right? You just eat less.
When you, huh?
You eat less because you're not hungry.
Yeah.
It's not the magic diet.
I lead with meat now, which I never did, you know, and I do find that I eat less because, it's very filling. Steak is very filling.
Yeah. Protein and fiber are the two most satisfying things we can eat. Satiety, right? So it has the most filling. So it's anything with fiber in it and anything with protein in it. So there you go.
So I want to thank the listeners for listening to WDRT 91.9 on your dial. You're listening to the Skeptical Naturopath. And I'm going to bring you back. Let's talk about Brazil again.
Oh, come on. I want to talk about the keto.
I know.
No, okay. The distraction, right? So the ultra-processed foods. So Brazil deliberately says don't eat ultra-processed foods. Right. They make that a point of their guidelines, right? And they also are focusing, you know, and they say ultra-processed foods are the problem. Whereas what do we say in the United States? We don't blame ultra-processed foods because there's a lot of companies in the United States that makes ultra-processed foods.
What are they?
Sort of. What else? Something even bigger than fat. Fat tends to be a big part of that, but what?
Sugar?
No, not sugar. We're not naming foods.
I don't know.
Nutrient excess. Too many calories.
Oh, right. Yes.
Just eat less.
Right. But not worried about the quality.
Yeah, not the quality. It's just we need to eat less. We have chronic disease, right? I mean, we're going to admit it. We've got a chronic disease problem. There's a first world problem of diabetes and obesity.
Yeah.
And cancer, you know, all sorts of other things, right? Western diseases. Western diseases that I don't know how much we see in Brazil. I'm sure Brazil's got tons of problems, right? I don't know deliberately. And I've got many issues as well. And they have a food industry there, too. It's not like they don't have that. It's just we got a huge nutritional industrial complex here. The feeding of Americans is a big, big deal. Right. Mm-hmm. And we can think about that, too. So who writes these dietary guidelines? Right. Because that makes a difference. So in Brazil, it's the Ministry of the Ministry of Health. I think that's the group that says it. I have it written down here. I got a cheat. Look at my cheat sheet. Yeah. Who writes it? Anyways, it's a ministry. Well, where are my little notes? So it's the food, you know, Ministry of Health. But who writes the dietary guidelines in the United States?
There's two groups,
so it's not just one group. Whereas in Brazil, it's just the Ministry of Health.
Right. There are various committees, I think.
Yeah, well,
there's
various committees for sure. There's a committee of researchers that get together and give their suggestions. And then there's the actual committee that RFK put together that then reviews that, but they still don't write it. So the workers at the... But so RFK is in charge of what? Department of Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's one. But there's another group that also plays a role in this. What's the other group? USDA.
The lobbyists for all the companies that make all the junk.
Yeah, but they don't write the guidelines. The other, who else writes the guidelines? So it's a combination of Human Health Services and then the Department of Agriculture. So USDA. So both of those. Okay. And understand the USDA, what are they about? Agriculture, right? They're about, you know, agribusiness. They're about all these things. So there's two different departments that, you know, co-write that together. Anyway, so you're trying to manage it, right? I mean, we can sit there and blame them and say, oh, they're just lackeys for this. But they're also working within a system. And it's a huge system. And within that system, you know, what are we going to tell people? And again, just the perspective is that we're trying to manage a food system. We're trying to manage a food system rather than necessarily questioning the food system. Whereas I think that Brazil, they challenge the food system. Right? They're deliberately challenged that and say, don't eat ultra-processed foods.
Yeah.
Whereas the United States, if we say don't eat ultra-processed foods, what happens? If the government writes that out and puts these guidelines, and again, who listens to the guidelines? Do you listen to them? Do you eat a certain way because the government tells you?
I mean, no, but of course we talked about this before. It's schools and
of course those are going to be dramatically affected if we start, you know, blaming ultra processed foods, and we got a really litigious culture too. Yes.
Yes.
So
yes.
These are things that happen. Right. So again, the United States is really trying to minimize risks, and they put it in a framework that is kind of unrealistic. Right. It's not user friendly. Like saturated fat, and they still kept the saturated fat. Right. You hear the idea that, oh, fat's not the bad guy. But if you still look at the guidelines say keep your saturated fat content at less than 10% of calories. But what does that mean? How do you translate that to eating?
Right.
Is it translatable?
I mean, you get on the internet and it gives you little pictures and you print it out and put it on your fridge. I think that's what people do.
Yeah, maybe. Right. Yeah. So you're trying to figure out, like, what has saturated fat in it? Oh, it's, you know, red meat and it's eggs and it's whole milk. And, you know, whole milk's fine. It's fine. We can change it. We just take the fat out and now there's no... Now there's no saturated fat in it. But what's the problem when you take the saturated fat out of milk? It doesn't taste as good, would be my opinion, but you get used to skim milk. Did you do this as a kid? We got used to skim milk.
I don't think I've ever had skim milk on purpose.
So my mom used to buy it. So it was whole milk and then it went to skim milk. And skim milk looks blue. I don't know. I remember drinking it as a kid and I'm like, it's blue. It's not. It has like a blue hue or something. Maybe I'm wrong. Man. That's what I remember. Childhood memories. But you get used to it. You get used to drinking skim milk, and then you drink whole milk. You're like, oh, I can't drink that. But anyways, what else do you lose when you take saturated fat out of milk? You take the fat out of milk. It's skim milk. What else do we lose from that?
Calories?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, yeah, we do lose calories. We lose fat-soluble vitamins. So we lose vitamin A and we lose vitamin D. Or you remove it because that's where vitamin A and D is. It's in the fat in the milk.
Oh,
so you skim the milk, you don't have A and D in it. And what do you see on the skim milk label? Fortified with A and D. So in our inherent wisdom, we know that, right? So it's like, hey, okay, well, we're going to take the fat out because it's a bad guy. But we're going to put the A and D back in it because we know what you need instead of kind of just like being like, well, maybe we just eat what the cow produces. Instead of like manipulating things. And again, I want to be careful that food, you know, fortification of food isn't like all bad, right? I mean, we're still messing with things. Like, we don't have pellagra because we now supplement, you know, we supplement the grains. So grains deliberately have niacin or they have B vitamins put into them and folic acid. And we've fortified that so we don't have pellagra. So that's, you know, that's possibly a good thing. But why did we have pellagra anyways? And we didn't see pellagra in native South American cultures that ate corn all the time.
Because we fractionated the original food, right?
Yeah,
and
of course.
In this case,
yeah,
I think
right.
we bred it to be more palatable.
Well, we messed it up. So with corn, it's a nixtamalization is what it's called. So when they're, you know, grinding corn or whatever, they actually put some ash in there, like ash from the fire, so they add an alkaline substance to it. And that actually releases the niacin. So niacin, which is a B vitamin, is now available to you. If you don't do that and you make cornmeal, that niacin is not available to you. And then what happens? You could potentially, if you're relying upon corn, which happened in the southern United States for a long period of time, corn was a staple. They actually developed pellagra. Dermatitis,
right.
Diarrhea,
dementia. I remember reading the book you suggested.
Yeah, right.
About
so,
that.
But anyway, so we in our inherent wisdom are like, well, we'll just fortify it. Or maybe we just should have processed corn the way that they used to do it. But we didn't. We forgot that, right? We looked at, we saw what they did, and we're like, we don't need to do that. We're just going to, like, we're going to process it in the way that we process it. Anyways, my point here is that fortification, quote-unquote, isn't all bad, but, you know, it's still us messing with the food instead of, like...
Yeah, I mean, that's one example, and it's because we didn't do it right the first time.
Correct.
I don't know. I guess I would argue and say I think the way we add stuff to food is inherently bad because it's done in a factory setting that bears no biological resemblance to the foodstuffs that we are supposedly enriching it with, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I mean, where is that vitamin A and vitamin D even coming from? Actually, when I was thick into looking at these things when I was macrobiotic, I learned at one point that vitamin D was actually detrimental to, it created stillbirths and deformities in babies if mothers had any reasonable amount, even not even too much vitamin D, that it's a really potent foodstuff that we add that really isn't a foodstuff, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, I don't know that. Now you got me interested. Maybe I'll look that up because breast milk does not have a lot of vitamin D in it.
Yeah, see, and then, so they were giving it to them as a supplement, and then it kind of went wrong. I'll see if I can find information about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Send that to you.
That was the
first thing that I learned about it, you know, in my 20s, and I just remember thinking, well, all those things are suspect if they're made in a factory and they're not coming from an actual food.
Right, and I mean, the point should be, like, why do we need to fortify to begin with? I think fortification, the quote-unquote value, is from a public health perspective. So that we're trying to treat everybody. And we say, oh, well, if we just put folic acid and niacin and everything, we won't see those deficiencies. And we don't want those deficiencies, but the deficiencies are there because we industrialized the food to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But so where should we really approach this? So we can fortify our way out of it. Or we can, like, look at the system and say, oh, maybe there's a problem with the system, similar to the dietary guidelines. Are we going to, like, break down the entire system of food production in the United States to get rid of ultra-processed foods? Is that what the government's going to do, right? Because it's part of what, you know, if you start challenging the food system and say it's broken, well, I think it is. I think you agree with me. But, you know, the guidelines are really managing that. And even saying eat real food is a step in the right direction, for sure. But it's kind of rhetorical, right? It's not the same as saying we need to eliminate ultra-processed foods from the food we eat. We should not. There's no tolerance for ultra-processed food or what, however you want to state that. So again, it's, you know, we have healthy dietary patterns. We, you know, don't eat too much salt, don't eat too much sodium, keep the sugar at a minimum. Right? I mean, they say that, but, you know, what does that mean? And how much sugar should we eat? Like, what's a safe amount of sugar?
Well, considering I think it's a neurotoxin, I don't know.
Yeah, well, this
I
is.
do imbibe on birthdays and celebrations, but I don't know. More and more, my daily life can't. I can't handle it. It
Yeah, I
does
know. Well,
feel
these
like.
things are just too sweet. Yes, you just eat something. You're like, well, I don't mind some sugar. Like, I don't want to get rid of sugar because, again, I'm not going to use stevia. I don't like stevia. I don't like the taste of stevia. Is stevia a problem? It's not a problem. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just got an aftertaste to it. I don't like it. I'd rather have sugar, but I don't want, so I would just use less sugar. But what is less and what is more, right? Moderation is a fatal thing because we don't know what that number means. And what's interesting in sugar, I probably said this somewhere along the way, when we look at like the Hadza, right? The Hadza are the hunter-gatherer group in, I don't know if they're in Ethiopia, where they are in Africa. They're studied a lot because they're an example of a native, right? They're eating how they're hunter-gathering like they've been doing for thousands of years. So they're, anthropologists love to go there and love to study things and look at what they eat and how they respond. And there's been a lot of interesting research from that. They've done like caloric measurements with them. They use a double labeled water. Anyways, all sorts of things. But when we look at their diet, they eat basically three things. They eat meat, they eat
Honey.
starches, yeah, and they eat honey. And the question is they, 15% of their diet is honey. On average, yes. And we're telling you, in the United States, we say eat less than 15% of your calories as sugar. And yet we've got the Hadza who are eating more than 15% or more.
But I mean, you're not giving the full picture
Of
of
course
like
not, because it's an
they are at
average.
a very, very strict diet. I mean, if we ate what they ate only, I think we could get away with 10 to 15% of honey. Do you
Yeah,
know what I'm
that's
saying?
one way. So my perspective is a little different, is that they eat honey when they find it. So their food priority list is if they find honey, if they have honey and meat and start and tubers available, which one will they eat? They will eat honey 100% of the time. If they don't have honey and they have the choice between meat and starchy, tubers, what are they going to choose? Meat. If they don't have honey or meat, they're going to eat potato or they're going to eat tubers, right? That's the kind of their priority list. And so if they happen to find honey, all they're doing is eating honey for like 2 days till the honey's gone. So 100% of their diet is honey. And then all of a sudden it's 0% until they find it again.
Because they don't, yeah, because they don't have access to it.
But we eat sugar all the time, right? We celebrate every meal with sugar. So is there a difference between eating sugar every day versus only eating it at huge amounts when we get it? And think about that too. I mean, in a culture where calories are at a premium, you want to store some fat, right? Fat is actually protective for you because you can withstand the famine. And sugar's pretty good at that, fructose specifically, at turning into fat in the body. And but if you're in a culture where you don't have enough calories, like that may be a bad that may that's a good thing. Whereas if you're in a culture where we have lots of extra calories, not such a good thing. Anyways, that's my perspective on that, right? But again, this is what we get to in the United States, right? We're telling us all to like limit these things. And then the other thing is fat was bad, and now fat's not bad, and eggs were bad, and now eggs are good. And so we keep changing our mind. Like certainly RFK is going that direction, right? He's like, hey, we need to increase protein. You need to increase your meat consumption. Is that the goal, to increase our meat consumption? I don't know. Again, are you blaming the bad guy? Is meat the bad guy or the good guy? And understand, we got a really powerful meat industry in this country, right? So somebody coming out and saying eat more meat, they love that.
That's there's a lot of
But is it bad, right? The question is it bad? And is that really the conversation we should be having? I mean, we've talked about this before. Talking about eating meat or not eating meat is sort of not the bigger, is not the important question. Right? The more important question, I think, is what kind of ultra-processed foods are you eating? And if you're eating more meat and eating less ultra-processed foods, thumbs up. If you're eating at macrobiotic, I mean, how many ultra-processed foods did you eat on a macrobiotic diet?
Hardly any.
Zero.
I mean, not zero.
Okay, not
You
zero,
develop
but
it
not.
because you had to, if you didn't work against your perfectionism, that was my issue, then you were actually more prone to illness, you know what I mean, and kind of weakness. You had to have chips every once in a while and things like that. In fact, at the macrobiotic conferences, we would go to Denny's and get fries and onion rings and coffee because we would only see each other twice a year. So we would kind of celebrate in that way.
Nice,
And
nice.
the very strict macrobiotic people thought we were insane, but we knew that 99% of the time we were, not eating anything but whole grains, vegetables, greens, seaweeds, greens, beans. I mean, very, very little that was ultra processed. Occasional fruit, occasional fish. You know what I mean? It was very strict.
Yeah, so again, ultra processed food at a minimum. And
Totally.
could you
Yes.
go on a ketogenic diet and be on a low ultra processed food diet? Yeah, if you're eating those
Oh,
things
yeah.
for sure. But you can also be dirty keto may mean a different things, but you could be eating salami and processed meats and you could start doing that. Yes, and then now you're still in processed food land, right? Ultra processed food land. And again, is that ultra processed? So is eating salami the same as eating chips or candy? I mean, that's kind of a good question.
No way, right? I mean,
Yeah, there's nitrates in there, right? There's going to be things that we add to preserve that. And there's some data that says that processed red meat, not so good. But processed red meat's not the same as red meat. Again, the point being is how much is this processed? And the best thing is, you just buy the food and cook it yourself
Right.
and stay away from that at all possible. So I'm not sure where salami and lunch meat and those things fit. But I would say, yeah, that's better than eating, empty, a chip that's an empty carbohydrate and an empty fat or a quote unquote a bad fat. Again, that's my definition of bad fat. Right, that's the whole seed oil thing, refined vegetable oils. And that's, a lot of the value of a keto diet, I think, is that you've taken out carbohydrates and you've taken out all those other foods that are also associated with the bad carbohydrates. Most of the bad fats come along with a bad carbohydrate.
Right.
Unless you're
Right.
eating, the fake margarine and stuff that's made with what I consider to be bad fats. You could do that, I guess, on a ketogenic diet. But again, right? So again, this is like backdoor approach. So we're saying, well, eat more meat. Well, you eat more meat, you eat less ultra-processed foods, maybe. But you could also go macrobiotic or, and then the researchers that are on the, vegetarian end of sides, they're all up in arms because now the government's saying eat meat, eat meat, eat meat, and they've been working all along to try to get us to eat less meat. Or there's something healthy about eating less meat. But if you replace meat with ultra-processed foods, that's a problem. Though I would argue those researchers agree on that. It's just that we're going to try to figure out what's the best message to communicate to Americans. Right? So that's kind of maybe where some of the quote-unquote backlash comes from, the researchers that sit on the nutrition guideline committee, because they're not writing that, they're just giving their input. Like they review the literature, like they're really good at that, and they're saying, "Hey, here's what the data is showing us." Anyways, this is what we have in the United States. Brazil doesn't even do that, right? They're talking about they're optimizing foods, they're optimizing meals, like eat with your family, right? They're talking about those kinds of things. Eat real food, cook together, don't eat out, those kinds of things. You tell you Americans don't eat out. This is always funny, right? When we're in a recession, how would we know that things were really bad in this country if we were really in dire? Where would you look?
Probably the grocery store,
Well, the
right?
grocery
Like,
store, people
what's.
still have to buy food, but what would they certainly not be doing if things were really tight financially? What's the first thing that would go away? Or
Eating out.
eating out. I remember recessions, and I'd look at the, the restaurants, and they're still packed. Like that
Yeah,
doesn't make
yeah.
sense. Like if things are bad, you would not eat out because you're paying a premium to eat out. Partly why I don't like to eat out. Well, I don't know if it's just because of pain, but it's kind of like, well, I make it at home, right? And I kind of like cooking, yeah? I mean, that's like stress management for me. Stress-inducing in other people, perhaps.
Yeah, right. It depends, right?
Maybe you're the same too, right? I don't know. Cooking is I don't know. That's like, I'm always going to spend time in the kitchen. Like, I look forward to that. I've embraced the doing the dishes thing. Have we talked about that? I don't mind it. Gabriel would be really happy to hear me say that.
It's a small price to pay, truly.
Yeah, he doesn't listen. So if he were listening, he'd be like, I'm never doing a dish again, Dad. You love to do it.
Yeah, you said.
Yeah, well, he gets graded, and his grade's not so good on doing the dishes. But we got this system down that he dries the dishes, so when there's a lot of dishes, and that way it works good. I'm like, hey, we make a good team here. And he's fine. And he's the salad maker at home now, too. Like, that's his job. And he can make other things, too. But anyways, I digress. Easy to digress, yes. So, but anyway,
I should just jump in and thank the listener again for tuning in to the Skeptical Naturopath here on WDRT's 91.9.
Yes. So again, we've talked about, you know, the difference between, you know, the United States isn't going to, I mean, I don't think there's that point to say, hey, don't eat ultra processed foods. Like, that's still the elephant in the room that we don't want to talk about.
Yeah, it's about convenience, and some people also argue that it's about, you know, affordability as well.
Yeah, for sure. This is the whole idea with the food desert piece, right? And when we start listening to messages about, well, you need to eat more meat. I just read this about somebody in the government, I don't think it was RFK, said you could eat this way on like $5 a day, $3 a day. Oh, I can't remember. I don't remember what it was that you could eat like
eat
healthy.
Way?
You could eat. You could follow these new guidelines, and you know, do it for inexpensive.
$5 a day.
I can't remember what it was. Maybe it was $7. Now you're going on my memory, which fails me, and I didn't think I was gonna. I'll go back and read it now.
I shoot personally for $30. If I can eat on $30 a day, I mean, you know, you're talking about two or three meals, and you want it to be quality.
Yeah, and do other people have $30 a day to spend on food? So this is a question. But you're going to prioritize it, yes? Because you're a foodie.
Yes.
I'm going to prioritize that.
I definitely make a point of spending a lion's share on food because I don't want to see a doctor, to be honest.
Yes, it's super important to you. And again, it's just a matter of like, if I have to cut somewhere, the grocery bill's not getting cut. There's all sorts of other things that I'm going to cut before it comes to that. Like, food is non-negotiable to me. So like, but anyway, so the idea, but that's, it's still an issue for people in this country. So how do we make food affordable? And what kind of food is affordable? You want to guess? Mm-hmm. Ultra-processed foods, because they don't go bad. If they don't go bad, you can, you know, they're there whenever. They're an energy source, a cheap energy source. Instead of being like, well, how do we eat more fresh fruits and vegetables? And that becomes, you know, more expensive. Though I would argue, though, that I think that you could do. Maybe we should do this experiment, right, to see how cheaply we could eat. I get this question at school all the time, right, because I'm seeing I have chiropractic students, and they're like, I can't afford to eat that way. I'm like, okay, but what can you afford to do? And if we got to eat, let's say, cheap meat, right, let's say factory farmed, let's say this kind of thing, but is factory farmed pork better than eating, you know, packaged food?
Right. It's all a question of,
I mean, that's a question, yes? So now the how that animal was raised, what the animal was fed, this kind of thing, I think that's super important. I'm going to spend money based on that. But if you don't have money, where are you going to spend it on that? Because you could buy cheap pork. Oh my gosh. What would cheap pork? You buy a pork shoulder, probably $2 a pound. Mm-hmm. You could cook that up. You could cook that in a crock pot, and you've got, you know, whatever, you know, put a roast in there and cook it in a crock pot, and you've got meals for probably 3 days. And you could turn that pork into all sorts of other things, right? You turn it into tacos, and you can turn it into, you know, put it on top of rice, you know, whatever. There's lots of ways that you could do that. But you still got to cook that, yes? But then you have, you know, crappy pork or crappy. Crappy is, you know, my definition and your definition. But to somebody else, that may be, hey, that's a step up.
Yeah, right. It's all relative.
Yeah, it's all relative. So that's just the idea that can you buy, you know, quote unquote food cheaper and still cook it? You know, the biggest issue, I think, is time and convenience and cost too, right? I'm not
cost.
Like cost is one piece, but also the time and the convenience. Because you have to turn that pork into something that you can eat. What does that mean? You actually have to cook it. And that takes some time. Though I still will argue, if you have a crock pot, it's super easy.
Yeah.
Super easy.
Right. Yeah, and they have all kinds of things like that, right? Like the air fryer and the, what's the other one?
Oh, yeah, I got a new kitchen toy. Have I told you my new kitchen toy?
Mm.
Yeah, my kitchen toys. So I got a combi steam oven, right, that I can kind of sous vide, right? Sous vide is cooking in water, but you're cooking in a steam oven. So it's basically a big toaster oven. And it functions, I can use it as an air fryer. I can use it as but I can steam, right? So I can set the steam level in there and it uses a lot of water. But what that means is I can cook at low temperature. And I can almost do the same thing as I sous vide when you cook it in you seal it in the seal-a-meal and cook it in water. That's the classic sous vide. We've talked about that, haven't we?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But this is a combi oven, right? So you can steam, you can sous vide, you can just use it as a toaster oven. So I'm still kind of learning it and playing with it, right? So I'm not sure it's a replacement thing, but it's my new little kitchen toy.
Yeah, that's cool. That's the dream, is to have something that you can use for so many different things, right?
Yes, and what I'm finding is it's really valuable for reheating food. Because I can reheat at low temperature and I can basically put it in steam and it works really good. And I don't have to overcook it, right? So I kind of do that, right? Like I will make a brisket and then I freeze it. And then I take it out of the freezer, and then I have to heat it back up. And if or I will cook so I don't really make prime rib, but I actually use chuck steak, and I turn it into, I sous vide it, and it turns out kind of like prime rib. I mean, not quite the same because it's thinner, but you can get that same kind of, you know, cooking it low and slow, right? And it's, you know, it's almost the same as that. The thing is that when you reheat it, you're going to heat it really high, and then, you know, the redness that you have from a prime rib, for example, you lose that because you're heating it at a temperature higher than the internal temperature which you cooked at. But when you reheat in steam, it's like fantastic.
Nice.
So that's, you know, I do lots of kind of shortcut things where I can cook in bulk and then I can freeze and then reheat. And I'm that's what I spend my time doing. Anyways. So, so this is the idea, like, how do you eat on a budget, and where do you choose? Like, what kinds of things are you going to choose to eat? Like, what kind of fresh fruits and vegetables are affordable? What kind of meat is affordable, right? And again, I would still say that, you know, eating organic is not important when you're on a budget. Eating, you know, not eating ultra-processed food is still the ultimate goal. Not using that as a, you know, kind of a fail-safe kind of thing. Okay, we still have some time left. So the other question I have is, why don't Americans even listen to the dietary guidelines? Why do we do this? I mean, we've talked about it, that that's for federal programs and the SNAP program and school lunches and that kind of thing. But, you know, on some level, like, why don't we listen to it? I mean, I look at the Brazil guidelines, I'm like, oh my gosh, you're speaking my language. Like, wow, you're challenging me to do these things, and I feel, you know, validated on that. When I read the United States guidelines, nothing. I don't get that. Right? And like, So we already said, right, you limit your saturated fat to 10% of calories. What does that mean? It means nothing. Or you put, you know, you put the food label, and then you're food labeling, right? You judge a food by its label. You don't judge a food by, like, does it taste good? Like, what can I turn this into?
I guess that's why I don't listen to the government either, because I'm looking at real-time labels of foods that I might be,
Yeah.
I guess that's part of the reason why I don't listen to the government as far as what they think I should eat. It just all seems very vague.
Yeah, so vague. So vague, right? Instead of Brazil, they say eat real food, cook, eat with others. I like that. I should be eating with others. Like, that's super important. I've told you, I think the potluck is the solution for the food industry. Is the answer? You know, that's the way we deal with the food industry. Eat together. Well, just eat with your family, even, right? I mean, it's like a ongoing cultural experiment, and then you're doing things because, you know, what does everybody, not quote unquote like, but what am I making? What can I make for the masses? Let's eat together, and then we're like sharing this experience instead of like, oh, I don't like that. I don't want to eat that. So then I make a separate food for one child and a separate meal for another child. Nope, that's not happening in my house. But, I certainly see that with patients, though, yes? So they're going on a diet and nobody else in their family's going to do it, or they're off dairy and nobody else is going to be off dairy, right? I mean, this is kind of a real thing. But, how do we just find, and again, if you need to be off dairy, like, how do you find foods that don't have dairy in them that you like, instead of being like, oh, I'm going to eat all these dairy-free things? Dairy-free cheese, and, you know, I've had lots of dairy-free cheese. Have you had dairy-free cheese?
A long time ago.
It's not cheese. Yeah. It's like it's totally ultra-processed food, too.
Yeah.
It sort of melts a little bit. Yeah, kind of. Cheese-like, maybe, right? It's just trying to get the texture
I have to say, it's pretty impressive what they've done, but it isn't tasty.
No, it's not. They're trying to mimic something. But again, you're going to ultra-process it to get to that. It's just better, like, well, what kind of foods do we eat that doesn't have dairy in it? Like, so if I go eat barbecue, how much dairy do you get in barbecue? Really nothing. I mean, maybe they serve you macaroni and cheese with it or something, but nothing to do with the barbecue that has it to do with dairy. Like, it's easy to be dairy-free when you do that. Whereas if you're going to go for pizza, nope, not going to work, right?
Right.
Well, you can eat dairy-free pizza and, you know, it's not, I'm still going to say that's not pizza.
I mean, it is what it is for those who need it, you know?
Correct.
I mean, I did that for many years, although I really preferred cheeseless pizza, you know, that's what I would do. Ann's or something like that, they make cheeseless pizza with a lot of vegetables.
Yeah, right. And then you're like, hey, I like this, and then I can make this, and it doesn't have to be cheese. And but is that by definition pizza? You're just, again, trying to find meals that, you know, how do we make this work? But honestly, I mean, I see that with patients. I say, well, go off gluten or go off dairy. And they're like, but I can't, you know, nobody in my family is doing that. Right. I mean, that's a real thing. But anyways, you know, this is the potluck is the antidote for the food industry, right? Because you're eating together, you're sharing a meal, you're bringing something that you made, right? Hopefully you made, you didn't just buy it at the grocery store, but, you know, share your food, put some love into it, you know, that kind of thing. Super important.
Yeah.
You know, and plus these guidelines, right? They feel more moralizing than motivating too. So we're talking about what not to do, what to limit, what you're doing wrong, right? It's not like you read these guidelines and you say, wow, I'm inspired. Though I will say, eating real food, I get a little inspired.
Yeah,
you watch that commercial,
for sure.
There's some inspiration there. So at the very least, whether that's right or wrong, there's at least some sense like, oh, wow, at least we're putting out a message that's a little different than eating on the food pyramid or eating the food plate or whatever that is. A pyramid, how do you translate a pyramid to my plate? So they're like, the pyramid's too confusing. We got to put it on a plate. So then you got your plate broken up into, you know, five parts. You're like, okay, well, all right, now here's how my plate has to look. I mean, completely unrealistic, yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah, there's always the question of how much as well, right? All these vegetables and fruit, how do you fit all that in? Yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, okay, well, 2/3 of my plate has to be that way. But honestly, you give me Brussels sprouts, I could eat my whole plate as Brussels sprouts. I love Brussels sprouts. Right? And well, I got to manage my plate, and I got to make sure I get this, and I get this, and I get this. I don't know. It's hard, right? I mean, I think, you know, maybe are we in summary? Possibly. Here's my, you know, that I really think that the guidelines in the United States, they're written to manage the system. Right. And they're written from a, you know, government system. And what is the government going to do for school lunches and SNAP program and the military and this kind of thing? But when we eat, we don't eat for, you know, the system. We eat inside habits, right? Inside stories and relationships and environments. Right. And you know this because you see how these foods are marketed, right? Like Coke and Pepsi. How do they market Coke and Pepsi? They don't market it as a taste. You know, like you,
What
oh,
do you
you love the
mean?
taste of that. I mean, how do they market Coke and Pepsi? Coke for sure, I know. How do
Well,
they
I think
market
it's
it?
just the it's the relationship that you have with other people as you're enjoying it
Yeah,
together.
correct. You're doing it because you're enjoying your fam, you're enjoying your friends. So let's get together and drink soda together. So Coke is what binds us. Are you kidding me? So let's sit around and drink poison
Wouldn't
together?
you like to teach the world to sing, Paul?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that. There you go. Perfect example. Right, so this is, you know, that we're selling a lifestyle. We're selling something that we can see ourselves in, and then Coke becomes a part of that. I mean, it used to be like the you remember the Pepsi challenge?
I don't know. I don't.
All right,
I
well,
don't.
I
I
got to do
yeah.
penance on this, so I'm admitting this too. So, you know, I'm a naturopath, but while I was in medical school, I actually worked for a company and I did the Pepsi challenge. So I drove a truck around and I'd go to events and I'd set up and I'd give people Pepsi and Coke and they would tell us which ones they preferred.
Really?
Oh my gosh, I was in medical school. Should I know better? Yes. Did I have to feed my family? I guess, right? I don't know, but I'm doing my penance. So I did that. But the Pepsi challenge is always sponsored by Pepsi because Pepsi almost always wins.
Oh,
If
really?
you're blind and you taste both of them, and you may know which one is Coke or Pepsi. Coke drinkers are always going to pick Coke, but the taste of them is different. Pepsi's a little sweeter than Coke is. And at initial, your initial take on that is you like Pepsi better because of the way it hits. It doesn't mean that you're going to continue to drink that or that's going to last to the end of the bottle. But the initial effect of that. So Pepsi wins the Pepsi challenge. That's why Coke never did the Coke challenge. Because
Interesting.
they'd
I did
lose.
not know that.
Yeah. So that's what they did. So, you know, I'm working for Pep. I didn't work for Pepsi. I worked for a company that hired me to do this. Actually, I didn't do it very long. I quit the job too. Not because I was peddling Pepsi, but for other reasons.
Clearly, you didn't have a problem with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess whatever pays the bills. So, anyways, there you go. It's out in the public now that I have a history with
Yeah, that's crazy.
Pepsi. Anyways. So, what else? What else can I say? Maybe we can,
We have 3 minutes.
we got 3 minutes. Wow,
Sure.
we have more than enough time, yes? Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe it comes to, you know, and I think that, you know, Americans, what do we need? Well, you know, how do we change habits? How do we change this? Because the thing is, we do have choice here. Right, we have the ability to make better choices. You know that, I know that, we do that every day, right? And I'm clear when I'm in a grocery store, right? I know, right? I know the things, I know what I'm going to do, I know what I'm going to cook. Like I have that down. But, you know, I see enough people that they want to change their diet, but, you know, what is changing the diet? Can you do that overnight? Does it take a year? Does it take 5 years? And how do you shift it? I mean, you've been through that, right? So you've been through that being macrobiotic for a long period of time. I mean, the quality of your diet is super high. And then trying to figure out, okay, well, what really works with me? And you haven't necessarily forgotten macrobiotic.
No, but it didn't serve me into perimenopause. That was really the
That's
deciding
a challenge,
factor.
yeah, right. So as long as your hormones are good, you're like, hey, no problem. But as soon as there's a challenge there, you're like, hey, wait a minute, I gotta like pay attention to this. I don't have my quote unquote hormones to rescue me.
Exactly.
I
I
mean, we
don't
have
have the
that
buffer
with
anymore.
cortisol. We have that with all sorts of other things, right? We kind of take these things for granted. Insulin, right? And again, we love to blame insulin. Insulin's the bad guy. That's why you gain weight. No, insulin's super important for us. It's just that we kind of trash that system over time, right? It's a cumulative effect. Cortisol, right? I mean, stress hormones. I mean, we blame stress for everything. Stress amplifies everything. Cortisol's not the bad guy, but we kind of look at it, oh, it's the bad guy. You know, you got to lower your cortisol level. Well, you're raising your cortisol level so you can adapt to your environment. That's not a bad thing. So how do you like kind of downregulate that or change things to try to say, hey, how do I chill on this instead of like, oh, how do I lower my cortisol or, you know, lower my insulin or flatline my glucose or, you know, these kinds of things. Anyway, so, you
Things
know,
to pay attention to.
I'll end with one thing. So, you know, the whole glyphosate thing now? You've heard that. Oh my gosh, I'm so disappointed.
In fact, it's I we don't have fabulous bread like we did in Viroqua, and I was buying Dave's Killer Bread because that was seemed like the best,
Oh
and
no,
I
do
just
you?
found out
So,
that it
what I'm referring to is that RFK has kind of gotten on to support the glyphosate production. Do you know
What did
this?
you say?
So, Trump has come out and said, you know, glyphosate is basically, you know, we need to protect that because we're protecting our food supply. And now he's pushing forth producing more glyphosate.
Do you mean in what?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
Producing
you don't
more?
know
Like
this.
making it?
Oh, yeah. Look it up. So, unfortunately, I know
Oh,
more of the
God.
news than you do. And then now RFK has had to respond to that. And he's basically saying he's in support of that.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'm so disappointed. I'll just leave it at that, right? I'm like,
That's a
glyphosate.
terrible note to
Oh,
end on,
gosh. Yes.
but we have to end.
Eat real food. But I guess glyphosate, I don't
Oh,
know.
terrible.
I don't know.
Okay,
I don't
well,
worry.
thank you again to our dear listeners. You're tuned in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher on WDRT 91.9.
All right, see you next time. Bye, Christina.
Indeed. Take care.